All right, we are live now. So, Malcolm, thank you so much for agreeing to be part of the College of William and Mary Hip Hop Collection.
Okay.
So, to start off with, would you mind just introducing yourself?
Yeah, my name is Malcolm Venable. Right now, I am a brand strategist at the Martin Agency in Richmond, Virginia. Previously, I was a journalist covering pop culture and music for a variety of publications, for Vibe magazine, Entertainment Weekly, Interview, Time Out, New York, GQ, and I guess most relevant, the Virginia Pilot in Norfolk.
Okay, so in terms of your family history, originally from Richmond, or?
I grew up in Essex, which is near Petersburg, Virginia. Actually, it's home to Virginia State University, so kind of a small town, college town, very predominantly middle class African American community. Then I went to college in the Richmond VCU. I studied journalism, and then after college, worked for about a year as a general assignment reporter in Richmond, and then I moved to New York to go to grad school at Columbia. I got a master's in journalism from Columbia, and then I started writing for magazines.
Okay. So in terms of where you grew up before you went to college at Richmond, how would you describe hip hop culture in that area?
In the part of Virginia, Brooklyn?
Yeah.
That's a great question. Actually, okay, so it was the early 80s when I was growing up, and it was a really sort of, I guess you could say, kind of heady time for a young black kid growing up, because the Cosby Show was really kind of like a very influential cultural driver at the time, and then the spinoff of that, A Different World, showed a lot of young black kids, footage which I had never seen before, and I still don't even think is even being done now, and they showed young black kids at a predominantly black school, and so I grew up around the corner from Virginia State University, which is, of course, a predominantly African-American, or historically African-American university, and my uncle was the head football coach of the school's team, of the football team. So I went to the games a lot, and I just essentially spent a lot of time with my kind of like adolescent and early teenagers hanging out on a college campus. And Virginia State University at that time even still had a lot of transplants from the Northern States. So there's a lot of kids from New York, New Jersey, Baltimore, I guess even D.C., and of course the Southern States as well. But what was happening culturally at that time was that hip-hop music was really starting to take hold and become the kind of cultural juggernaut that it is. So I was being exposed to music from a lot of different regions, and even at that early time, the kind of hip hop culture was already had kind of regional influences. So you definitely saw New York kids that were a little bit more harder edge. New Jersey had a very kind of like house oriented scene because house music is big in Jersey. Baltimore was the same, with a very kind of like clubby music. And then DC had a big like go-go element to it. So I was seeing all of that. You know, I was like the 11 or 12 year old kid. And, you know, this was a time that big hip hop groups were emerging. So, you know, Kool Moe Dee, gosh, Real Rock Fan, goodness gracious. Big Daddy Kane, EPMD, some really kind of like early seminal hip hop groups, KRS-One, all that stuff was, you know, coming at me from a variety of angles. It had a real big impact on my whole kind of experience.
So in a lot of ways, Virginia State University and you growing up, the fact that so many folks were coming through from different parts of the East Coast and the Northeast, and also, you know, Virginia, D.C., that there was a, I mean, would you characterize it as an incubator in terms of hip-hop style at that time?
I definitely would, and as a matter of fact, then one of the things that ended up being really popular was the New Jack Swing thing. That was really emerging as well. So I definitely was seeing, the kids kind of taking Ted Riley's sort of, hip hop New Jack Swing take and fast forwarding ahead significantly. I remember actually meeting Teddy Riley and, getting to know him slightly when I was a reporter. And so it kind of came full circle for me to actually, meet him and talk to him, get to know him a little bit. But I also remember, too, I had family that lived down in the Tidewater area, like Portland.
Mm-hmm.
And so I remember very vividly the Oceanfront riots. And that footage from that riot ended up in a Public Enemy video. I guess it's the, I want to say it's the Don't Believe the Hype video. And don't quote me on that, I could be wrong. But anyway, there's footage of kids fighting cops in that video. And, all of that was sort of intertwined with all these kids coming down from New York, as I was mentioning. And so, all those forces just kind of coalesced together. You had these kids that had this sort of real sense of identity in their own culture that was beginning to move past being assertive into almost like an aggressive state. And yes, I would say that the schools were definitely an incubator because they allow all these kids who were from different, regions of the country that. And hip hop was their kind of lingua franca, and it kind of collided and clashed and coalesced together.
Okay, so I'm curious if. I'm curious about your first memory of hip hop, if we can sort of trace it back. If there's like a seminal moment in your mind when you were like, "Oh my God, what is this?" This, and then and then it's hip hop.
Okay. Wow. The earliest memory. So my uncle, again, as I said, was a coach of the football team of Virginia State. So his son, my cousin, is about 7 years older than me. So when I was, like 8 or 9, he was already a teenager. And so, being a black teenager at the time, the music was wet. A lot of them latched onto it. My cousin did so. So he would be hanging out with his friends and I was hearing him. I remember him asking me one time in front of his friends, "Can you rap?" And I said, "Sure, I can rap." And he goes, "All right, rap." And I started doing this really lame beatboxing. And all his friends laughed at me. And so, really, I don't even think I really even knew really, really, really what it was. Because my personal home was very kind of comfortably middle class. So my parents listened to like OJ's Earth, Wind & Fire. And personally, I was very much in the R&B. So I listened to Stevie Wonder and Prince and stuff like that. So I don't even know if I had a real firm understanding of the hip hop culture initially. I got first asked about it as like an 8 or 9 year old kid. But in time, I got exposed to my cousin to Gosh, Fat Boys. He liked the really hard, edgy stuff. Kumo D, Two Live Crew. I really like Terrence One because I like the message of it. But my earliest memories of it honestly were a little bit. Afraid because it was just so brash and intense and a little bit loud. Coming from my own personal experience.
I mean, it's interesting. I mean, brought up identifying pockets and areas to grow up in terms of middle class. I'm just curious if there were in any sort of class tensions or generational tensions over. Hip hop identity versus perhaps like identifying more with R&B or something else that you experienced or sort of noticed during that time growing up.
They were apparent in my own home because my parents were pretty not only kind of comfortably, quietly, aspirationally middle class bourgeois black people. you know, so much so that I always say that, like, I never had that sort of, like, ghetto experience. It's not something I really relate to that well. Because, mm-hmm. you know, both my parents went to college. My grandfather went to college, which is, you know, practically unheard of for a black man in the 30s. So I never really had that sort of experience of, you know, projects and ghetto. I didn't even know what a project or a road looked like until I was well into my 20s. So, in my own personal home, additionally, my parents were very church-going, kind of, just kind of quietly middle class. So, they didn't even allow me to listen to music that they considered to be offensive or demeaning. I remember I got in trouble for having a Prince album, and I had to hide a Prince record. But it might have been she and he had to hide it. So, early on, there was definitely not any rap music in my house. Not until I was in my teenage years when I started listening to, like, Tribe Called Quest and stuff. But in those early years when I was, you know, a real small child, and hip-hop was just starting to come into availability, like, you know, because for a while you couldn't really even buy, like, rap albums, you know, so... I'm 35, so in 1984 I was 7. By that time is when social media take off with my DMC and it's I obviously wasn't old enough to buy an album, so I didn't really have that in my home.
Mm-hmm.
So again, like, it was all kind of new and raw and thrilling and exciting, but a little bit dangerous for me because it just wasn't directly tied to my own personal experience.
Okay. Now I actually want to sort of skip ahead a little bit in terms of your own personal history to VCU in Richmond, and if you wouldn't mind describing the sort of hip-hop cultural scene once you got to college.
Okay. Just to kind of give a little bit more texture really quickly, again, like, I was a lot of R&B and stuff, and then by the time I was getting ready to go to college, I'd obviously... you know, I was into rap and like rap music, but I was really into reggae at the time. So, by the time I got to Richmond, my best friend were pretty much kind of gravitating towards Rastafari and like hardcore reggae music. And then that's kind of when I started to get like really into hip hop. But I like kind of, I guess what you would say, message hip hop and like militant. You know, so I was really big kind of outcast. I always loved Terrace One. Just because my own upbringing, my parents definitely raised me to have a sort of pride about my ethnic background and heritage. So musical choices I like fell in line with that. Stuff that had like a purpose and a conscience to it. So I kind of fell into the sort of, how do you put it, sort of, not necessarily militant, but just sort of like pro-black, I guess you could say. The Wu-Tang Clan, all the different various groups that came out of it, like Rascast, Outkast, well, that's not really the Wu-Tang, of course, but Outkast, Goody Mob, kind of like alternative indie hip-hop music that had kind of like a social conscience. And then actually in Richmond, you know, a lot of my friends were in groups, so... couple people I went to college were affiliated with this group called Super Friends. That included Matt Skills, Lonnie B, Danger Mouse, all guys that are still here. They're very much relevant now. I think at that point a lot of people I knew either aspiring rappers or, you know, working with some sort of deal or something. So, yeah, I know a lot of people that were MCs. And then actually another friend was in a group called Infectious Organisms. His name is John Baptiste. And John's group, Infectious Organisms, had a really big following. And today, John is a songwriter, and he lives in L.A. He does a lot of work with the Black Eyed Peas. He's writing for, he's written for Madonna. He's written for Police. He's written for Chris Brown. And for a number of people. But so John's group, Infectious Organisms, in college was pretty, you know, kind of like, I guess you could say, a digital planet kind of fly, two guys and a girl. Mm-hmm. And by the way, they were playing this music, an enormous impact on me. I still admire that group today. I think their second album might be my favorite album of all time. But Sean got affiliated with, I think, Outkast, and then he met will.i.am, and that's why he got to today. So Outkast, I mean, just a quite an answer, but especially I was listening to a lot of kind of political rap, and then, you know, I had friends locally who were in groups that turned out to be pretty influential.
Now, in terms of a reggae scene, what type of reggae scene was in Richmond at the time, or was there a reggae scene in Richmond?
Yeah, it was kind of probably big, but it was definitely sizable. I was in a band, and difficult to actually quantify, but, you know, sure, we played locally and stuff like that. I mean, Richmond definitely has a very kind of, at least at the time anyway, had a very kind of distinctly acute African-American sense of cultural sensibility. So within the kind of, you know, Richmond, it definitely has a very kind of sharp appreciation in African American community, sharp appreciation of culture, of his own culture. So the music was just sort of offshoot of that, and the reggae scene at the time was, you know, sizable.
Yeah, I'm just curious, is there, to this day, is there still, what is the reggae scene like today, if it's something that you even pay, is it something you still pay attention to or interested in?
Well, yeah, my best friend is actually the lead singer in a very popular local band called Antaro. He's a very they're the leading reggae band in town.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. You bring up the sense of not supporting their own. I mean that has definitely been something that lots of folks that I've sat down and talked with have mentioned sort of statewide. So, I mean, is it something that's characteristic of Virginia, or more so in terms of, like you said, that it's, unless it's a historically developed scene like Austin or Detroit, then perhaps?
Yeah, I just think it's a consequence of the structure of the business. So, radio stations don't decide what they're going to play. They are told what they're going to play by program directors who are more or less in bed with the industry. So, you know, it's very complicated and mathematic and precise, but I play on the radio way to do with whatever company has invested the money to make whoever a star, not really talent or even interest. And, you know, lots of local people write about that. To Richmond and beyond, I think that's going to be a better job giving help to local talent. We have some really strong, good radio stations down there, B104, you know, Shaggy does a good job at the small program directors have, and he really makes it a personal crusade to support local artists, even if that kind of falls out of his expected job duties. Generally speaking, local artists don't really have that great of a time getting the exposure they want, and I think that might be just like a larger market, but I think a lot of people in Virginia like passive, like a flyover, or just sort of like, there's not a large market, they in turn would expect consumers in the market to kind of be spoon-fed rather than lead.
Now, want to actually jump tracks a little bit. I'm curious about your time spent with the Daily Press, right? Oh, okay. Sorry about that. But yeah, so talk about your time sort of covering culture in the area before during that period. Yeah, would you mind talking about any of the sort of any hip hop culture that you covered when you were working for the Virginia Gazette?
Oh, okay. Sorry. Wow. Well, I mean, I got down there just kind of hit the ground running. You know, I just quickly, met and made friends with people at the radio station, kind of allowed me to meet a lot of people. Yeah, I mean, I think, obviously, it's such an enormous impact at what, you know, Teddy Riley started. Teddy Riley, I think, is really the sort of godfather of the 757 hip hop scene. I mean, he's not from there, but I am moving down there, opening that studio in the late 80s, early 90s, just had such a profound impact on the musical scene in the area, and really, frankly, the local economy, and to some degree, national music history. I mean, Teddy Riley, according to the legend, you know, he came down there and opened his studio and started producing for artists, including Michael Jackson, Heavy D, MC Light, etc. He, to some degree, I think he might have given a little bit of mentorship to Timberland and Missy, I think. But I know for sure that he used to host this talent show. And I think he paid for it out of his own pocket. And as the story goes, he hosted this one talent show where these three kids performed. And he met them after and basically allowed them to become kind of mentees or kind of interns in the studio. And those kids, of course, were Pharrell Williams and Chad Hugo, who, you know, obviously have done everything in music that's probably conceivable to do. And the spillover effect of their success, I think, has given so many people down there so much enormous pride and so much, you know, it's just given them kind of reason to believe that they could also do it. And so, in addition to that, too, I mean, you have, well, I'm going to mention Bruce Hornsby, but he's not hip hop. You had an enormous boom of groups that wanted to be like them, or again, just figured that they could make it like them. And that is an enormous thing for a region. And woefully, you know, they never really have gotten the support from the, you know, the cities at large that they should have. A lot of people, you know, would say that if they had been white and if they had been, you know, country artists or rock stars, then they would have gotten so much more, you know, enthusiastic support from the city. I mean, Pharrell and Chad have had an enormous impact on music, and Timbaland and Missy too. You know, they've broken numerous records, they've sold untold number of albums, they work with every artist that, you know, is worth anything. And, you know, there's not a street name for anybody, there's never been a parade, there's never been any kind of effort to sort of leverage their talent. I think that Pharrell one, which is an amazing thing. But other than that, you know, you could say that their impact is not really maximized as much as it could.
And why is that? I mean, is it a simple? I mean, well, is it something as sort of complex yet simple as an issue of race and in terms of and it's hip hop or perceived as?
It's very complicated. I think there are a number of factors, and rattle them quickly. I think, you know, race has everything to do with it and nothing to do with it.
Okay.
So nobody wants to see a whole bunch of poor black kids, you know, quote unquote, ugly black kids in the streets, just pumping their fists in the air wondering about. There's a, in this country, you know, a fear of a galvanized black youth movement in type of people. And I think, you know, the whole scars from the oceanfront experience that I mentioned earlier haven't fully healed. And, you know, people are just scared. And you know what? Some of it's justified because anytime you take people who have been marginalized, and I don't even mean historically, I mean like yesterday, you take kids that have been jammed into the projects, don't have any hope, don't have any goals, don't have any, you know, major role models, people that feel like nobody cares about them, and they have nothing to lose, they are a little bit dangerous. But by and large, those are the factors. That's the race thing. That's the youth thing. Nobody wants to see. I mean, it's like a Footloose. Like everybody's afraid of a whole bunch of rowdy kids, black or white. And then, additionally, I think there's just a generational misunderstanding. I think by the time people get into a position of power where they actually can facilitate, you know, stuff like that, then they don't care. I mean, you know, if you're 40, you probably really don't give a whole lot of thought about why you would want to have a big ta-da for a bunch of 18-year-olds. You don't really think it's that important, even though it is. And then I also think that that area is such a working, not so much working class, but it's such a family-oriented place that, you know, it's really not a priority. You know, in a family-oriented town, people will focus on stuff for kids. And it's also a big military place, too. So, you know, investing in their own cultural opportunities may not be the biggest priority.
Okay, so now that we've discussed a little bit about hip-hop culture, just sort of music and some issues around it. Curious about how you define hip-hop.
I think that that has changed a lot. I think it's a culture that is in flux, which is cool. You know, I think it might be characterized, if the music at least, hip-hop music, I think, is pretty much always going to be characterized by spoken word. You know, some of the cool rapping. But hip hop has, you know, been dissected, diluted, changed up, switched up, altered from it so many different ways. You can see the influences everywhere. So, you know, I've written about this before, how a white artist can do the same music as a black person is. So for Justin Timberlake, for example, you know, released two really amazing albums under the direction of Timbaland and the Neptunes. The first one was both, the latter one was just Timbaland. And he was singing R&B. On the first album, his first single was with Clips, like a pretty hardcore rap group out of Virginia Beach. And if he was black, then that would have just been an R&B album. But it was Justin, so it was pop. Similarly, you can take Pharrell's song, or Pharrell and Gwen Stefani's song, Holla Bad Girl, right? You know, it was a hip-hop producer, and by and large, Gwen Stefani was rapping on the song, but, you know, she wasn't, because she's white. That's what it boiled down to. It had been, you know, I don't know, anyway, you know, Rihanna or somebody, they would have probably called the rap song. So, I just think that those definitions get changed. But by and large, hip hop music is going to include some spoken word, typically kind of like a more kind of aggressive beat where the drum sound is more prominent. But at this point, the genre has expanded so much that, it doesn't really have an easy categorization.
And sort of following, obviously talking about Timbaland and Pharrell and even Teddy Riley when he became an honorary Virginian, when he set up shop here, want to follow this idea of, is there a Virginia sound when it comes to hip-hop?
Yes and no. I think, as I was saying before, that Virginia has become such a Virginia is such a big melting pot because of its physical place in the country. Virginia is sort of an absorber of so many different styles. I mean, we're in the middle, so we get New York hip hop, we get New Jersey house, we get Baltimore club music, we get DC go-go, we get Atlanta down south dirty music, we get all of it is sort of a mashup. And I think that you see that in the work of the most prominent hip hop artists from here, Missy, Pharrell, Timbaland, Charles J. Chat. They kind of make an amalgamation of all those different sounds. But if you had a character like that, I would say it's like upbeat, high intensity, not as aggressive, it's more. It's kind of midway. It's not down tempo, but it's not as hardcore either. It's very danceable. It's very upbeat and happy and danceable, I think.
Okay. Do you view yourself in terms, do you sort of, the way that you think about yourself or create your own sort of personal identity, do you view yourself in terms of hip-hop history and culture?
In my words, yeah. I mean, I personally don't really listen to much hip-hop anymore because I'm kind of bored with it. I'm really much more now into, garage. I'm more indie. I do like hip-hop, but I'm very kind of indie, so... like Shabazz Palaces, I like, I like the Vivian Banks, I like, I'm warming up to, Drake, who's obviously not indie, but...
Right.
I just personally find that a lot of the messaging in hip-hop is a little bit... First of all, though, because I've been listening to it since I was a kid, it's been over 20 years, and I just feel like... Everything that I'm hearing, I've already heard before.
Right.
And then also, to a lot of it, it's just really negative. You know what I mean? Like, I really don't want to continue to hear, over sexuality, at least not in a one dimensional way. Because I'm finally hearing about sex, but I would like for it to be clever. And, hearing, bitch get on the floor and shake that ass, it's like, well, that's not really that. Stimulating to me. And then, so I'm more kind of into indie rock, electronica, big on, and always love R&B, so I kind of gravitate towards that.
Now, in terms of some of the your own personal listening habits, have you could you describe the way in which hip hop has influenced like indie rock, R&B, electronic house?
Oh yeah, I mean, I think tremendously. So I think the idea of having an R&B song now without a rapper on the hook is kind of not even a thought anymore. Like, that's pretty standard. So, and that's something that Teddy Riley pretty much pioneered. I also think you hear an electronica drum beats and drum patterns are very hip hop. But I mean, even like Sugarland, I really like Sugarland, and one of the songs that I've done the most, I think it's called All I Wanna Do, she raps on that song. you know, she breaks it down. She's like, I'm a girl from the APL. She's rapping. Mm-hmm. And she's pretty naughty, but it's not like it's sort of intended to be kind of clandestine. She's making it clear that she's rapping on a country song. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, the influence of hip-hop is just enormously large.
Mm-hmm. And so you mentioned that I think you said something like, you know, outside of work is where hip-hop not so much, but with your work, I mean, does that have something to do with in terms of, like, branding? I mean, because, you know, hip-hop has become ubiquitous in terms of marketing and branding certain products in general.
Yeah, I think, well, one of my friends, and I have to give him credit for this idea in my head, his name's Eric Green, and he works at a company called Rural Interactive in Norfolk, and it's a shop that is pretty much rapidly becoming an advertising agency. They're very good. But Eric made an excellent point to me, said that the practice of sampling from hip-hop has gone on to influence so many things, like the idea of a mashup or a remix, starting with hip-hop, but you know, a mashup is something that you're seeing on the highest levels of culture, like Target and Neiman Marcus. Mm-hmm. Any other variation. I just saw Hermes and Comme des Garçons. So people are learning those lines, and that really, really is a hip-hop concept. So there's that one part of it. And then, you know, I think marketers are definitely looking to leverage hip-hop culture, but it's tricky because you can't just put the people breakdancing, you know, you can't just have people breakdance over Pinefall. It's not going to work. And then, in a similar vein, I'm constantly asking people to please know Jay-Z. I mean, because I like Jay-Z, I think Jay-Z is dope, but it's like, I feel like a lot of people just want to use Jay-Z to sell things, and it's just kind of a lazy approach. Because he's become such an enduring icon, and rightfully so, he's fantastic, but there are other people out there, and there are other people who other people who project certain ideas without being Jay-Z. And again, I think, too, as I was kind of alluding to earlier, the prevailing kind of theme for the hip-hop thing is, you know, from the streets, from the ghetto, from the hood. That's not my experience. I don't really know what that is. I don't know that. You know what I mean? I didn't come from that, and I know a lot of people in a similar vein have a similar experience. You know, our parents went to college. Our parents expected us to go to college. You know, like, I never held a gun until I was an adult. You know, never. You know what I mean? Like, of course, I smoked pot as a teenager, but who didn't? I mean, like, I didn't have a kind of hood ghetto experience.
Right.
So I think that a lot of people, marketers, I mean, a lot of marketers want to use hip hop to sort of project this sort of like urban, I'm cool, yo, I'm down with that movement. And I mean, that's not really necessarily everybody's experience.
I mean, with the sense of now, I'm curious, pick your brain a little bit about this, is now that, you know, hip-hop has been 35, 40 years going on now, are we seeing, I guess particularly I'm thinking of like Drake or someone like Kanye, but the sense of like middle-class rap being a thing now.
Yeah, I think Kanye is an exceptional example of that. And while I find some of his personal behavior a little bit atrocious, I think he's an exceptional artist, and I think he's very gifted. And yeah, I mean, he's a great example. His mom's a professor, you know, he's a high art. He gives the impression that he reads. So I think Kanye is a great example of that kind of middle-class rap, sort of thing. I'm trying to think of some other ones that might be relevant off the top of my head. You know, as I said before, like, Digital Planets was a huge influence on me. There are others, but by and large, that whole thing is just something you don't really see a lot. You know what I mean? Like,
right, right.
We've had this discussion in the office about when we start talking about luxury and aspiration, because, you know, when we're using, for example, kind of set the tone within the hip hop world, you know, having champagne and, you know, I'm drinking for a full glow, and I'm drinking this, and it's like, well, that doesn't impress me because my parents let me have champagne when I was 12. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? So,
right, right.
it's sort of like, it's you don't really see a lot of people addressing that reality of the middle class black experience, which is interesting given that, you know, there's a very middle class black family in the White House.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, there's a severe dichotomy. The spectrum doesn't really have, the spectrum has a polar exchange. You have the Obamas, and I guess arguably, like, maybe the Tyler Perrys or something culturally. But there's a whole lot of people on the other end of the spectrum talking about, you know, the ghetto and the hood. But by and large, you don't really see a lot of people in the middle saying, well, of course I went to college, of course, you know. Of course I can have a interview or whatever, but not because I'm trying to impress anybody, just because it's a good car.
Right. Okay, so now I want to switch it a little bit again to dig in a little bit more on sort of regional and state history.
Yeah, but I should warn you, I do have to go to a meeting at 2:30. Sorry, we can extend later if you want.
Oh, okay. Yeah, let's see. We can. I've got somebody. I got another interview at 3. So yeah, I mean, we can do it at another day too.
Yeah, that's totally fine. I'm sorry, it just came up.
Oh yeah, not a problem. I mean, I appreciate you being willing to talk. Anyways, so let's see. Yeah, you want let's shut it down for now. Is that cool?
Oh yeah, you want to shut it down, or do you want to just ask one more and then? Okay.
Actually, yeah, we'll give you one more because I just was curious about if you wouldn't mind running down a sort of important or notable clubs and venues.
Oh, that's a great question. Okay, that's a really good question. I think, as I told you before, I'm finishing a story for Richmond Magazine about Super Friends of Richmond, which I think is provides a kind of, I don't want to say exhaustive, but it's a good retrospective on their influence here in Richmond. So when it comes out, think if you can get your hands on it, okay. That'd be awesome. And if you remind me, I'll send it to you. But anyway, the clubs in Richmond were the Slip at Chaco, I think that's how you look at it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a big one. Blakely's was a big one in Richmond.
Ooh, okay.
Blakely's, the Slip at Chaco. Oh, the Flood Zone was huge in Richmond. In Tidewater, I know that there was a place called the Boathouse that was big.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Goodness gracious. Boathouse. Even now, I don't know, it might be close, but the Cave, like recently when I was living there, was big. That might be all I know. I'm sorry.
No, No.
I remember, especially during the early years, people were scared to book those acts because they knew somebody was going to get in a fire shot.
Mm-hmm.
So they would have the hip hop artists in the hotel ballroom. So that would be, you know, it's not like a club; it's just like a one-off event. You know what I mean?
Oh, okay, so it would just you just book the ballroom. There you go.
Exactly.
Okay.
Because
so
the police can't shut down a bar. The city can shut down a club, but you can't really shut down a hotel wall. You know what I mean?
Right.
It's just something you rent it for the night.
Okay.
If I think of some more, I'll make a list.
Yeah, no, yeah, because we're trying to track down, you know, clubs, any sort of periodicals, you know, stuff like that, labels, you know, just sort of doing the history of it.
I think Shaggy would be a great resource for those questions.
Yeah, yeah. Had dinner with him and his boy Kevin Mack the other day. So, well, cool.
I'm so sorry, but please, I'd love to keep talking. So.